thanks for having me. So I had uploaded a title and abstract that was more technical. And then after coming to the talks, I realized probably we better just give a more general introduction and overview. So I apologize if you came expecting a more advanced talk that will stay on some more kind of basic material. But I think it's still, I'm hoping to have some pointers to some interesting questions, I think, at the end. So hopefully it will be entertaining anyway. So the starting point, what I want to talk about is, I guess, the complexity class MIPSTAR, which if you are having a map in your head of different subjects and you're thinking contextuality, then next to it maybe we have non-locality, right? And MIPSTAR is something we study in non-locality. And I want to explain how we can understand MIPSTAR through binary constraint systems and how it's kind of a tool that's come out of the MIPSTAR equals RE theorem from the past few years that's kind of really handy. So the starting point, I know it's come up in a couple talks already, but I think it's good to start with a familiar, something familiar. So let's start with the Mermin-Perez magic square. So what we do is we write down a 3x3 grid, we fill it in with variables, we write down, so this would be the point of view that's handiest for this talk, we write down from this 6 linear equations over Z2 saying that the rows sum to 0 and the columns sum to 1. And then what we observe is that this, this linear system has no solution over Z2. However, it does seem to have a quantum solution. So we can assign unitary matrices, let's say x1 up to x9, to the entries of this 3x3 grid, such that, what do we want a quantum solution to satisfy? We want these to be observables of order 2. So for each one, it's like we're assigning either 0 or 1 to it. So now we're going to change that to be plus 1 or minus 1, but it's really the same thing. So we want xi squared to equal 1. And we also want that they are like a solution to this linear system. If we're going to say that the values are plus or minus 1, then we, instead of saying that the sum will be 0 or 1, we want to say that the product is the identity or minus 1. So we'll say product across rows is the identity. And product across the columns is minus identity. And then the last thing we want is that xi times xj is equal to xj times xi if xi, xj are in the same row or column. Okay, so in other words, we want x1, x2, and x3. They should all commute with each other. So should x2, x5, and x8. Okay, whereas x2 and x6, they don't have to commute with each other since they're not in the same row or column. So we call this a quantum satisfying assignment. And the story we tell when we have a quantum satisfying assignment like this, but no solution in Z2, is that if we were to imagine these being measurement operators, and then the system being in any state, okay, we could say, okay, we fixed the state of the system, and then I'm going to measure a given row or column, and what I'll find is that the joint measurement outcomes always either sum to 0, or if I picked a row, or they sum to 1 if I picked a column, okay? And because there's no solution over Z2, we know there's no way to just to kind of assign values to definite values to each of the variables in such a way that the system will have that property. So what it seems like is that the kind of operator assignment to X1 knows whether it's being measured in the context of a row or a column. And so we would say the operators in this quantum satisfying assignment are contextual, or we have contextuality. So so these are maybe some of the first example of systems that have contextuality. So now I want to explain where non-locality comes in. So what we need to do for non-locality is to upgrade our scenario to a game. So I need to tell you how to turn this into a game. So let's do the Merman Perez game. So what's going to happen in this game? Very simple game. We're going to have a referee, and then they're going to send a row or column index. To each player, let's call the players Alice and Bob, so I'll write an A and a B. So also here a row or column index, okay? And then they're gonna apply with satisfying assignment to given row or column. If you want, you can think of it really what the referee is giving each player is an index 1 to 6 of one of these equations. And they're going to reply with a satisfying assignment to the variables in that equation. So if they get the first one, they should reply with values for x1, x2, x3 that give 0. If they get the last one, they should reply with values to x3, x6, x9 that sum to 1. Okay. So both players are going to do that. And then they win, so the referee takes these answers and decides whether they win or lose in this game. And the winning condition is if the assignments are consistent on the common variables. Common variables. Okay, and they lose otherwise. So what we see in this game is that there's no way to win. Okay, so actually maybe I should just say a little bit about this. So let's just think about what happens. So one player is going to get like a row or a column. Maybe they get the first row. And the other player gets maybe the first column. Okay, so they're going to output values for x1, x2, x3, and x1, x4, x7, respectively. And they win if they give the same value for x1. That's the common value. If they're both given the same row, then they have to output exactly the same thing. What makes this difficult? We say that they're not allowed to communicate during the game. So no communication. So in particular, Alice doesn't know what value, what equation Bob received, and vice versa. Right, so it's kind of exactly the same thing we see in the contextuality scenarios where Alice maybe is trying to figure out what values to output for x1, x2, and x3. She knows Bob might be receiving the first column, and thus they have to output the common value on x1, right? But she doesn't know if it's kind of x1, x2, x3 that they have to agree on, or maybe whether Bob received actually a row, right? Doesn't really know in what context the values she's outputting are going to be compared to the values Bob is outputting. Okay. So what we see here is that it's not possible for Alice and Bob to play this game perfectly with classical resources, which really means shared randomness, if you want the technical term. Okay. However, they can turn any quantum satisfying assignment into a perfect strategy using entanglement. Okay, so when we say that Alice and Bob aren't allowed to communicate, there's different ways we could interpret that. And one is to say, well, maybe they could still be entangled, right? And very hard to exclude that possibility given our understanding of physics, actually. So, and if we do allow them to have that, then there's actually a way for them to win this game every time, even though there's no classical satisfying assignment to this square. And if you look at what we've done here, there's really no reason why we needed to use the magic square specifically. We could write this down. So this is where we're going to get into binary constraint systems. We're up to three, I think. So binary constraint system games. Okay, so rather than starting with the square here, I could imagine instead I've got some binary constraint system. What does that mean? Well, we should have a set of variables. Like with our square, we had x1 up to x9. And then we should have a set of constraints on those variables. And what do we mean by constraint? So maybe we've got, VICI, I equals 1 up to m. So these would be the constraints. What is in a constraint? We pick a set of variables. So this is a subset of x. And then for our ci here, ci would just be a subset of 2 to the vi. Let's say z2 to the vi. Okay, so z2 to the vi would be the set of assignments to the variables vi. And then we just want to say, what are the satisfying assignments? So ci here is the set of satisfying assignments. Okay. And then given a constraint system like this, I can just turn it into a game exactly like this. I imagine I've got a referee. And they're going to send an index of an equation to each player, two players in the game. Like before, there's no communication allowed between them during the game. They each have to reply back to the referee with a satisfying assignment for their given equation. So let's say A in CI and B in CJ. And then they win if they're assignments are consistent on the variables they have in common. So we would want A restricted to the common variables to be equal to B restricted to the common variables. So that would be winning over here. Okay. And I should say this notion, this generalization, comes from Richard Cleave and Rajat Mittal. And from looking at constraint systems, we can get lots of examples of games which have this property that we can't play them perfectly with classical resources, but they do have perfect strategies with entanglement. Okay. Let me say a little bit about what it means to have a perfect strategy with entanglement here. Okay, so. We can play perfectly with classical resources here if and only if there's a satisfying assignment to B. So I'll use some notation here. Okay, this is classical winning probability. So this is if and only if B has satisfying assignment. Okay. And then we can talk about quantum satisfying assignments. Okay, it should be a map phi from the set of variables to some unitary group. Such that we have all of these being order 2. And they also need to satisfy the constraints. So we would say, there's an algebraic way to write this, but we could say it like this, joint, let's say that they're, let's do this first, phi x, phi y equals phi y, phi x, if x and y belong to vi. Okay, so in other words, if we have two variables that appear in the same constraint, then their assignment should commute. And what that means is if you look at all the variables in a given constraint, vi, sometimes we call these contexts, by the way. They all have to commute. That means you can think of them as like jointly measurable observables, so you can look at their joint spectrum. So we could write this down completely algebraically, but I'll just say it in words, joint spectrum of phi x for x in vi belongs to Ci. In other words, when we measure those observables, we want them to actually satisfy the constraint. So, it's a good time to ask questions if anybody wants to jump in.
And so, sorry, just to clarify, that is satisfying with respect to any state, right?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so if you think of it as working with games, but if you want to look at contextuality scenarios, each one of these would give a state-independent contextuality scenario, assuming you don't have a ordinary satisfying assignment, I guess. Okay, so what happens if we have a quantum satisfying assignment? So quantum satisfying assignment in this space implies a perfect quantum strategy with the maximally entangled state in CD, tensor CD. And we can also write down WQ. Let's say that is the supremum, or let's say it's the supremum of winning probabilities with quantum strategies in CD, tensor CD. And we take the supremum over any D here. Okay, so we don't put any bound on the dimension we're looking at. So it's not quite true that having this value be 1 is the same as having a quantum satisfying assignment like this. Because what can happen is that you can have things that are approximate quantum satisfying assignments for any d with the degree to which, let's say they're epsilon satisfying assignments. You can have that with epsilon going to 0 in finite dimension. In terms of strategies, we say you can have quantum strategies which get arbitrarily close to 1 in finite dimensions. So we have to worry about that. However, we can say that the quantum value is equal to 1 if and only if there's a quantum satisfying assignment. The operator algebra has invented a solution for this. And you can look at a certain operator algebra called the hyperfinite 2-1 factor. We want to be in its unitary group. Okay. So you have a perfect quantum strategy if and only if you are in this. Actually, I have to be a little careful. You don't want to, that's too small maybe. You need an ultra power of that. Okay, there we go. Anyway, it's kind of some magic machinery that means that we can write down the same algebraic conditions and talk about quantum satisfying assignments without having to worry about approximate assignments and so on. Okay. The next thing is, so if there are no questions about this, the next thing to talk about is is MIPSTAR. So what is a MIPSTAR protocol? I guess the question when you look at this is, well, can we do anything useful with this? Okay, so what is happening in this game is that the provers, essentially, are trying to convince the referee that they have a satisfying assignment to B. So the provers say, hey, you've got this constraint system. We have a satisfying assignment to it. And the referee is very lazy in verifying this. Okay, they don't want to actually have to have them list out everything. They want to just say, okay, I just really want to just check one or two constraints and see if your assignment's good. So they put the two provers in separate rooms so they can't communicate. And they say, okay, I'm going to ask you about one constraint. I'll ask you about another constraint, and we'll see if you're consistent on the overlap. Okay. So, but what the existence of quad satisfying assignments for some BCSs say is that this is not a good strategy to use to verify that that a constraint system has a satisfying assignment if you care about classical satisfying assignments. Okay. But in general, the idea of looking at of trying to have proof systems for things, okay? If we want to have, if we want to be able to have a system where we can be confident that something's true based on some information that somebody provides to us, it's a very productive idea to look at what are called multi-prover interactive proofs, okay? So in which case we have a verifier who's trying to verify something and is doing so by interacting with multiple provers who are unable to communicate with each other, okay? So MIP is multi-prover interactive proof. Okay. And all the multi-prover interactive proof, if you're seeing it for the first time, it's helpful to have the word system there. All that is it's a probabilistic Turing machine. Instead of calling it the referee, we'll call it V for verifier. And it's interactive, okay? So that means it's like a computer program that is able to, the probabilistic part means it's able to flip coins, okay? And the interactive part means that it can ask questions and receive answers from other parties, which we assume are not communicating. And because it's probabilistic, it can kind of flip a coin to figure out what particular questions it wants to ask of the provers. And based on the answers they get, it can then choose the next answers and so on, flipping coins at each stage. So we say, a language L is in MIPSTAR, MIP, let's say in MIP. Let's say MIP first. Is in MIP if there is a verifier. So this language, by the way, we're thinking of it as a subset of maybe like binary strings. Okay, if there's a verifier V such that if X is in L, then there is a way for the provers to convince. Oh, there's something I was going to add to this picture. Sorry, I left it out. It's very important. So what's going to happen in this is that the verifier gets as input X, okay, and then does all this stuff over here. And then at the end, they have to come up with, win or lose, but in this case, we should call it accept or reject. Okay, so that's the idea. They're going to either accept the string X or reject the string X. Reject, that's not how you spell that. There we go. Okay, And because they're probabilistic, that will happen with some probability. Some probability that they accept and some probability that they reject. Okay, there is a way for the provers to convince V to accept, let's say with probability one. And two, if X is a binary string, which is not an L, there the probability of accept is less than 1 minus S. Across all possible for all possible actions by the provers. So there's no way, even if the provers have a kind of unlimited computation, to convince the verifier to accept with probability higher than 1 minus s. And the last thing we want is V runs in polynomial time. In the size of x. So the verifier shouldn't have to do too much work to do this, this proof system. This parameter s that's there, it's called the completeness soundness gap. Okay, and so by default, we take this to be constant. But in many situations, this being greater than 1 over inverse Pauli is fine. And so MIP is where we are assuming that the provers here are just, you know, they're unable to communicate, and we understand that in the classical way. Maybe they have shared randomness, but nothing more than that. Okay, and with that assumption, MIP is actually equal to NEXP, which is pretty pretty interesting in and of itself. Okay. If you think of the verifier having polynomial time, that means they only have time to look at like a polynomial size proof. So if they were just interacting with one prover, and we weren't in the probabilistic setting, we would have the complexity class here NP, right? They have to look at some proof that's provided by a prover and decide whether to accept or reject, right? So NP is a lot smaller than NEXP. So by adding multiple provers, and also going to a probabilistic setting and so on, all the things that come with that, we actually get up to NEXP with MIP. But it's really the multiple provers, it's not the probabilistic part that makes that up to NEXP. And this can be done, so in general, one of these protocols can involve like polynomially many provers, because in polynomial time, the verifier has time to do that, and really big, you know, question and answer sizes. But this can be done with just two provers and limited communication. This is, if you want to read more about this, it's part of the whole story that led to the PCP theorem in computer science. So very big deal in the 90s. And still, obviously, but. So they can get it down to the same, I think, as the PCP theorem, right? So. Which comes into, polylog length questions, I think, and constant answers. But don't hold me to that afterwards. But I think it's along those lines, and I think that might be quite it on the nose. I meant to put that in here too. Right, so in general, no, right? But two provers, one round, and limited communication. Thank you. Yeah. So one round meaning you ask for, you put in some questions, and you get one round of answers back, and you've got to decide on that, which looks like a lot like a game, right? At that point, we're essentially playing a non-local game with the provers. We ask some questions, we get answers. Okay. So MIP star is the same as MIP. But now with entangled provers. So all the communication and everything is still classical. The languages we're looking at are just subsets of binary strings and everything. But we just changed the assumption on what it means for the provers not to communicate. Inside this class, let's see, what's the best way to say this? Yes, okay. So inside this class, we can look at the following class, BCS, MIP star. Okay, this will be, so in general, we can have many provers, many rounds of communication, and so on. But for this one, just two provers, one round, and every interaction is the BCS game of a binary constraint system BX. Okay, so in other words, for every string, there's a binary constraint system that we can write down. It's not helpful to say a little bit about what we want on the on these systems. So we want there to be like a set of variables. And we'll have constraints, VI, CI, and let's say I equals 1 up to M here. Okay. If we think about what is what we need, we'll need this the constraint CI to be checkable in polynomial time. And then we need the number of constraints, m. Those are the questions. In polynomial time, we have time to ask questions of length polynomial, which means m could be exponential. Okay. And the answers are assignments to the vi. Okay. So that's the number of bits that we're getting on question I. So this has to be polynomial in size of x to be able to build a proof system out of it. Okay. And we need them to be uniform in some way, of course, as well. So kind of one Turing machine that can generate all of them. So the question is, do we have a similar result to this MIP equals NEXP for the class MIP star? And it turns out we do. It's called the MIP star equals RE theorem due to G, Natarajan, Vidic, Wright, and Ewan from just a few years ago. And it actually says that not only can we get every thing in MIP with two provers, one round, and limited communication. We can do it with a BCS MIP star protocol. Okay. So, and furthermore, the power of the whole class is RE, which is basically the same power as the halting problem. Okay, it's the recursively enumerable languages. So I'm going to state the theorem like this then. There is a BCS MIP star protocol for the following language, HALT, which is the language of Turing machines M, so M Turing machine, such that M halts. Okay. And remember, the verifier in these protocols is only still doing polynomial amount of work, even though, so if you have a halting Turing machine, there's always a way to prove that it halts. you just run it until it halts. But that could take a very, very long time, right? So verifying that proof as a classical proof is, could take as long as checking that each step of the computation is correct. In this MIPSTAR protocol, it's a polynomial time verifier. So this theorem is saying there's a polynomial time way to check, assuming the provers, are able to generate entanglement among themselves and have a kind of unlimited computational power to verify that a Turing machine halts. So this is with constant soundness gap. And initially, the same parameters as here, but actually there's an upgraded version of this from Natarajan and Zhang, which says you can do it with, different parameters. So the CI has to stay checkable in polynomial time. We can't improve that. But we can make the VIs be polylog size of x, okay? So remember, that's the number of output bits. And the m we can make constant. This is kind of incredible. So in the interactions from the prover, there's only really like constantly many questions that they actually ask the provers here. Really, really strange. So the reason this tells you that, so this implies that RE is included in MIPSTAR, and then to show that MIPSTAR equals RE, you have to observe that it's contained in RE. But actually, you can get something even a little better than that, given let's say MIPSTAR protocol V, okay. And input, let's say for language L, we can let M, and I need the input now, okay. And string X. Let's let MX be the Turing machine which searches for a strategy, a prover strategy, let's say, a prover strategy to convince V to accept X with probability greater than 1 minus S. Okay? And then when it finds one, halts. So what we have is a Turing machine that halts if and only if we're in a yes case for L. Okay? So MX halts. If and only if X is in L. Which means that if we just plug this into the BCS MIPSTAR protocol here, we get a BCS MIPSTAR protocol. Even if we started with a really nasty protocol that involved many rounds of interaction and so on, we now turn it into, just right away, a BCS MIPSTAR protocol with one round of communication, two provers, and a constant soundness gap. And it's completely it's really hard to write a program to search for strategies, but once you've written it once, then it can just take the V as input, right? So it doesn't need to do anything complicated in the transformation to anything. So the upshot of this is not something that's been out for a while now, I guess, but I think is very neat. And the main message I kind of want to communicate is that we can work with all of MIPSTAR as a BCS MIPSTAR. So we can understand, for some definition of understand, all of MIPSTAR using BCS MIPSTAR. So I want to just highlight, so then the question is, well, what can we do if we, what can we do if we actually have BCS MIPSTAR instead of MIPSTAR? Well, the nice thing about constraint systems is that we can do logical reductions with constraint systems. So maybe let me just give an example. So this is the very last section, logical reductions. So let me just give an example of a logical reduction. So given a constraint, C on vars V, we can add new variables and write V as let's say new variables. Let's go up to W, still containing the old set of variables, and rewrite C as a three-set instance, D on W, such that, let's say phi is in C, if and only if phi restricted to if and only if there exists psi in D such that psi restricted to V is equal to phi. Okay, so kind of an equivalent formula for the original formula. And so something we've been working on, this is a joint work with Kieran Mastil, is that I'll give you the informal version. Okay, so reductions like this do not change the soundness gap in protocols. Not hard to see, okay? But it's kind of nice. You can apply any kind of classical logical reduction that you can apply clause by clause to a BCS. So if you're starting with something here and you're changing each one of these contexts without modifying the context, you're just applying a logical reduction to this. Doesn't change the soundness gap at all. So an example of something you can do with that is rather than using BCS MIPSTAR, if you want every constraint to be a three-set instance, you can make it so. The other thing is, though, sometimes you want to actually do more than this, okay? So sometimes you want to say something like, maybe you have a constraint x1, or x2 or x3, and x1 or x4 or x5. That would be like one constraint on x1 up to x5, right? But sometimes maybe you want each constraint to actually have a single three-set clause in it. So so let's say, could you replace this with two constraints on x1, x2, x3, and you can split constraints like this into two. And classically, they're like exactly the same constraint system. So what changed? And I think this is something that should be maybe interesting to people interested in contextuality. What's changed is we've changed the context, right? Here we have one context, a big one with all of x1 up to x5. Here we have two. And the practical upshot of that is that here we're expecting x2 and x5 to commute, okay? Because they're all in the same context. And here, x2 and x5 aren't in the same context. So it's possible to have these two not commute in a quantum satisfying assignment. So they're practically different things. So the other thing I'll add to this is proposition. If we have a good splitting, and all we need for a good splitting is to say that every pair of variables in the original day constraint appears in some new constraint that we add, which we can add that by, we can force that just by adding lots of empty constraints, okay? So good splitting, implies soundness gap does not drop off too badly. And the upshot of that is that you can do things like saying that MIP star is a subset of 3-sat MIP star, where 3-sat MIP star is now means that every constraint is actually a 3-sat clause. Okay. Unfortunately, I need to say with a polynomial gap now, inverse polynomial gap. Can't do that with a constant gap yet, I don't think. And it's an open problem to try and get better drop-offs here, something that's work in progress. Can we do anything more interesting than this? Well, I'll just give this as a, I want to end with two pointers to other papers. But one of them is a paper that has this in it. So we can actually, basically by applying classical perfect zero knowledge transformations, get that MIP star is equal to perfect zero knowledge MIP star. These are proof systems where the verifier can be convinced that something is true without actually learning anything beyond the truth or falseness of the statement they're being convinced of. And so we have a proof in this paper with Kieran that this is true, basically by looking at what happens in the classical case, and then it's always a little bit of extra work that comes up, but mostly you can just kind of apply pretty standard transformations to go from a general MIP star protocol to a perfect zero knowledge one. The other thing I'll say is that when you look at a question like this, we get a question of what's the smallest class of relations we could put in there and still have this be true? And this seems to be a really deep question. In particular, we still can't figure out if MIP star is a subset of lin MIP star, only the linear relations. It seems odd that we might even suspect that, but we do know if you don't care about the gap, that quantum satisfiability for linear systems, actually if you think about the Mermin-Perez magic square, right, we know that that can have a quantum satisfying assignment even though it doesn't have a classical one, that's a linear one. So we already know something weird is going on for the linear systems. And in fact, it's, you know, if you ask about without a gap satisfiability problems for linear systems, that's, we know that's undecidable. So it's plausible that this could contain all of MIP star, but we can't figure it out. And it's very closely connected to some kind of highly desired questions in pure mathematics, like the existence of a non-hyperlinear group. So anyway, I'll stop there. Thanks very much for listening.